想法给另外那一个人。所以他这是他第一点，我们的世界在变得很快。那在这个变得很快的世界里，你有两个选择，你可以选择不管这些变化，然后就是说你就继续做你以前在做的事，变化没变化你还是继续做这些事，还是你自己也去改变自己，但是你可以融入这个新的世界。所以他举了很多例子，比如说就是这个变化的例子，可是我们也可以想到很多，就是我们会做的事，比如说以前我们会投资在不知道在银行里面投资会更好，现在可能有新的模式，有很多这些和以前不同的东西，你是否要继续做你以前做的还是改变。但是他说到这里，请问你们有没有觉得不新的地方要解释？好的，那就继续说吧。
A different problem, one people have worried about for a while, is what I refer to as the death of copyright. That in order to enforce copyright, you have to be able to stop people from copying. Everyone in this room has got the equivalent of a printing press for ebooks, right? Anyone with access to a computer with a disk drive can make copies of any intellectual property that's in digital form. That makes it very hard to enforce intellectual property law, to enforce copyright law in particular. The obvious solution is that's what the law says, we have to enforce it. And then you think about what you would have to do in order to actually enforce copyright law. You might have to set it up so that every computer in the country at any instance could be searched over the internet. You might try to modify all computers so they couldn't copy things unless they had permission. Either of those looks like getting rid of bugs by burning down the stable. It looks as though solving the problem does much more damage than the problem does. What is the solution? The solution is to find other ways in which creators can get paid for creating that don't require control over copying, because we're not going to be able to control copying for much longer. Can't now even. One way, if you think about something like Microsoft Word, about a computer program, is that you don't worry about individual copiers, but you only make your money from large organizations. That if I want to pirate Word, I could do it. But if my university wanted to pirate Word, somebody who was mad at them would tell Microsoft and they would get in trouble. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is to try to treat intellectual property really as property in the sense of defending it yourself. So that there have been various ideas for ways in which you can create something that can't be copied. And for most intellectual property, that cannot work. And to see why it cannot work, imagine that I sell a song inside a computer program, and if you want to play the song, you've got to send some money to me online, and I will release it and then plays the song once. All right. Why can't that work? Because all you have to do is to have a tape recorder next to your computer, and the song is now permanently out. That is what is referred to in the literature as the analog hole, the hole in protection. The fact that once a work is fully revealed, whoever it's revealed to now has a copy. On the other hand, you can use technological protection for intellectual property that is not fully revealed. So that if what you have is a database, Lexis and Westlaw are large databases of legal information that lawyers use. And if I make a query for some law case that I'm in, I could make copies of the answer, but nobody else wants the answer. That was my question. So as long as Lexis and Westlaw can keep their servers from being accessed, they can sell access without giving it away. And at one time I was wondering if there was an equivalent of a movie that somehow was done in such a way that it was different each time you saw it, so that recording it was no use. And I eventually realized that not only is there one, I'm a customer, because that's what World of Warcraft is. World of Warcraft is a competitor to movies. I can record my adventure in World of Warcraft, but nobody wants it. They want to have their adventure. So one implication of this is that something like World of Warcraft can be protected and a movie cannot be. And that may mean that more and more creativity will go into games rather than into movies, because it is possible to charge for them. Another very common way is that you give your intellectual property away in ways that get you paid indirectly. When the Macintosh computer first came out, it had a word processor and a drawing program, MacWrite and MacPaint. They were free. You could make copies as much as you wanted. But they only ran on the Macintosh. So Apple was paying for writing the programs in the price of selling the computer, that the programs made the computer more valuable. Another very common example for musicians is that you give away your music online. That gets you fans, and the fans want to hear you live in a concert, and you sell tickets for the concert. The equivalent in my field is that you can write books or articles, and then the result is that nice people invite you to come to China and give a speech. And Switzerland and Spain and Jerusalem and Seoul, a few other places. I don't know if you know, but a little over 100 years ago, a number of prominent writers, such as Mark Twain, made a large part of their income giving public lectures rather than selling books. So those are all ways, and I'm sure there are other ways I haven't thought of. But my point is that faced with the fact that it's getting harder and harder to use the old way of rewarding authors and singers and film rights, the solution is to say, is there a better way now that we can do it? Let me take a different case. Defamation means lying about people in public in ways that hurt them. Slander and libel are the two usual terms in English. Defamation law says that if you lie about me in public in a way that injures me, I can sue you. In order for that to work, I have to know who lied about me, and he has to have enough money so that it's worth suing him. But nowadays, with the internet, somebody can publish a false statement to the entire world, having almost no assets, and if he's clever, without even telling anyone who he is. If you think about all the ways you can set up a web page, set up the web page, put up your slanders, and then run away. So that means that using defamation law online to stop libels online is getting harder and harder. But there are two ways of stopping somebody who lies about me. One is to sue him, and the other is to answer him, to respond to the lie with the truth. The same technology that makes it hard to sue people makes it much easier to answer people, because it's a communications technology. And my favorite example is now a little out of date, but there used to be a part of the internet, there still is, but it isn't very important now, called Usenet, which was a whole lot of online conversations. And I could very quickly search the Usenet for my name. And if anybody mentioned my name on any of a million conversations, my computer would tell me. I could write a response, and the response would be in the same thread on the same Usenet group as the original statement. So almost everybody who had seen the original statement would see my response. I used to say it was as if I was sitting on a hill, and if anybody in the world mentioned my name, the winds of the world blew it to my ears, and I could speak an answer, and it would blow back to the ears of everyone who heard it. I think you can do this. I haven't been active long enough on Facebook or G+ to be sure, but I think you can do about the same thing there. What about the web? The problem on the web is that if you put up a webbed lie about me, I can put an answer on my web page, but the people who read the lie won't see my answer. There is a technological solution, and the solution is to use web browsers which not only show what the page links to, but what links are coming the other way. So that you want a web browser so that if I link to your page, someone reading your page will see my link. That's a backlink web browser. That is technically doable. There is a possible legal problem. One could argue that a backlink browser violates copyright law because it is taking your web page and modifying it. And whether such things do was actually a legal issue in a different context not too long ago. But the point I wanted to make, which is what makes me interested in this example, is that the solution to defamation online may be to avoid interpreting copyright law in ways that prevent the solution to defamation online. That is, the solution to defamation online is to answer it. And all you have to do is to avoid developing laws that make it hard to answer people. All right? All right, you want to? You think you're all right?
Okay.
Oh, up to you. I mean, I'm willing to keep going straight through.
所以刚刚费德曼先生就给了几个，举了几个例子。 我就不把一个一个例子都解释了，你们我刚刚说的大概意思也还是一样的，然后他也说到了就是那个 copyright 的问题，就是版权的问题，因为现在网络，对，他的点就是说，他想说的就是，我们现在是有很多新的问题，而这些新的问题的那些解决方案都是。 一些新的科技给我们的解决方案，他刚刚举的那个 copyright 的例子，就是想给你们看到这一点。Another
way in which technologies change things, the way I've been talking about, is they change what we can do. They make it easier to listen to people's phone conversations and copy computer programs and many other things. But there is a subtler change that you also have to deal with. And that is that all of us deal with the world through a set of approximations. We have a simpler picture of the world in our head, in our laws, in our language, than the world really is. For example, we all think as if everybody in the world was either male or female. If there are biologists in the audience, they know it isn't true. That there are people who are genetically male, they have XY chromosome, and physically appear to be female. Not very many. There are people who have XX chromosome and appear male. There are people who have neither. There are people who have XXY chromosomes. I know one. And they look male, but they sometimes have some odd characteristics. There are people who are genetically male, who appear to be male, but think in their heads that they're female. There's one fairly famous economic historian whose name changed from a male name to a female name when she arranged to have her body altered as best she could. McCloskey. Donald McCloskey became Deirdre McCloskey. So, if you really think about it, saying everyone is male or female is a good approximation. It's usually true, but it's not precisely true. I'll come in a minute to the question whether everybody is alive or dead. But that, again, it's much easier to write laws if there's a sharp line between alive and dead. Sharp line between male and female. And the fuzzier those lines get, the harder it is to think, to talk, to make laws. Let me discuss some examples where technology has broken our old approximation. We think we know what a mother is. and a father. There was a real case in my state of California of a child with five parents. Husband was infertile. Wife was doubly infertile. She could neither produce a viable egg nor bring a fetus to term. That's why we have markets. They hired a sperm donor, an egg donor, and a host mother to produce themselves the baby. Problem solved. Baby born. At which point, the couple get divorced. Who are the legal parents? The literal reading of California law is that the mother was the host mother, because what the law said was that the mother of a child was the woman from whose body the child was born, and the father was the husband of the host mother, because there is a legal rule going back to the 18th century that says that the husband of a woman who has a child cannot dispute his paternity of the child. All right, old rule. The court instead, I think very sensibly, ignored the law and said, we will define parenthood by who intended this child to come into existence. So it's the original couple who are the parents, who have the obligation to support the child, the right to make decisions for the child, the normal things that parents have. But I thought it was a nice example where what seems like a simple answer becomes less simple. And it could get much worse. Let us suppose that Microsoft decides, or make it Apple. Apple is better. Apple, as you may know, suffered a crushing blow because Steve Jobs died. He was the soul of Apple. Well, we have markets to solve these problems. If somebody had a sample of Steve Jobs' tissues, cells, and if we were a little better at cloning, Apple could clone Steve Jobs and bring him up. Who is the parent of that child? Apple? Apple, I guess. My point is only that as the technology changes what can happen, the categories we use to make sense of the world sometimes break down. Let me take the next one. Everyone is alive or dead. Imagine that you are dying of an incurable disease and you are a technological optimist. You believe we will keep getting better and better at medicine. You arrange to have your body frozen. This is real, by the way. That is, there really are people who have done this. You try to have your body frozen in a way designed to do as little damage as possible, especially to the brain. And your hope is that as medical science progresses, it will be possible to unfreeze you and bring you back to life. And then possible to cure whatever was killing you. And that's probably the easy part. Bringing a frozen body back to life is going to be much harder than curing cancer. This is referred to as cryonic suspension. And as I say, there are something like 100 to 200 people at present who have done it. They haven't come back, but they're frozen. How do we deal with this situation? Is the frozen person alive or dead? Is your wife a widow? Do your heirs inherit? When the hospital froze you, was it murder? We know the answer, unfortunately. There was somebody in California who decided to make a court case of it. He had a cancer that was destroying his brain, and he wanted to be frozen now, not after he died, so that they would bring him back whole. The court said no. The court said, killing you and freezing you now is murder. It is not allowed. Fortunately, I gather, the cancer then regressed. So I think he did not, in fact, die, at least not very soon. Let us suppose that I get myself frozen, that my heirs inherit, my wife remarries, and then medical progress goes very quickly. And 10 years later, there is a news story that they have brought back a dog. They have taken a frozen dog, and they brought it back, and it barked. And everyone can see what the future is going to be. And the next day, my wife's second husband and my heir break into the storage facility where my body is preserved in liquid nitrogen and smash it. And when they are arrested, they agree that they are guilty of some kind of an offense against the storage facility, of vandalism. They say they could not stand having someone dear to them preserved in such a pretense of life. But what is the one crime they could not have committed? Because I was legally already dead. The hospital gave me a death certificate before they froze me. So this suggests some of the interesting ways in which the technological change raises new issues for the law. Let me take another set of issues, and these are some of the ones that first got me interested in these things. How many people here know what public key encryption is? Raise your hand if you do. Fairly small minority. Suppose I want to send somebody a message that nobody else can read. The old solution is I have a way of scrambling the message, of encrypting the message, and I give the key which tells how to unscramble it to the person who wants to unscramble it so he can read it. And that way, if the message is intercepted, it is gibberish. Nobody can read it. The problem for that is that I have to have a safe way of getting the key to the other person. Because if I can't safely get a message to him, maybe the key will get intercepted, and then someone else can read my messages. And this problem was solved, I suppose, about 30 or 40 years ago, must be 40 by now, by a mathematical procedure called public key encryption, in which you produce two keys, such that a message that one key scrambles, the other key unscrambles. So now the one of those keys I tell everybody. That's what we call my public key. The other key I keep secret. If you want to send me a message, you scramble it with my public key. You send it to me. The public key can't unscramble it. So only I can unscramble it. So we now have a way in which people can have secure messages with strangers. All I have to do is to publicize my public key, keep my private key secret, and anyone who wants to send me a secret message encrypts with my public key. I will show you at the end of this where my web page is, because I've written about this at much greater length than I can in this kind of a talk. But this is an extremely powerful technology for creating a world where what I call a world of strong privacy. A world, for example, where you can sell illegal services and have a reputation, but where nobody can know where you are or who you are. All right? So it's a way of combining reputation with anonymity. And that has good features and it has bad features. At the same time, there is another technology. And the other technology is surveillance, video cameras watching people. And video camera watching people doesn't seem that scary, because after all, there are people watching people. Ah, but we also have computer programs that can recognize faces. So suppose we've got video cameras everywhere watching people, and computer programs that are analyzing to say who are the people they are watching, and databases organizing that information. We now have a world where anything you do in public not only is recorded, but is findable. So I like to imagine a court trial 50 years from now. And the prosecutor, who is a little bit out of date, says to the defendant, "Where were you at 3 p.m. on Friday the 17th? And his assistant, who's more up to date, sort of whispers in his ear. He says, "Oh, I'm sorry. Just a minute." Types on his computer. There it is. That's where you were at that time on that date. Because everything that's happened in any public place is recorded, searchable, findable. So that means that at the same time that one technology could give us more privacy than we ever had, another technology could give us less. What if we get both? Two critical questions. One of them is, can I control my access to cyberspace? It does no good for me to be typing into an encrypted software if there's a little thing the size of a mosquito with a video camera in it watching me type. Right? Technology is getting stronger and stronger. Video cameras are big now, but they're smaller than they used to be. Well, this is a video camera, among other things. Make them enough smaller, and you have video mosquitoes. All right? And at that point, it's not only public places. At that point, almost everything is recorded and searchable. Maybe the low-tech solution is I type underneath a hood so nobody can watch. Or maybe I have a cybernetic dragonfly that hunts video mosquitoes. And the higher tech one would be a direct link between your brain and the computer with nothing visible in between. All right. The other question is how much that matters happens in the real world and how much in cyberspace. That after all, you can give lectures in cyberspace. You can organize conspiracies in cyberspace. You can commit crimes in cyberspace. You can slander people in cyberspace. If enough of the things that matter are in cyberspace, then the real space surveillance has nothing to watch. Oops. Do you need more? Okay. If you want.
Okay.
I'm not sure when you...
So, 比如说他说很新的那些科技可以使我们想象的东西虽然我们很确定的东西都可以把它们变成习惯比如说我们对母亲的定义以前 100年前我们对母亲的定义其实是很准确的然后我们也知道母亲是什么现在我们觉得自己知道不是我们真正的知道吗 他刚刚举个例子就是一个孩子就是一个夫妻两个都不能生小孩然后最后这个孩子就有五个家长哪一个是妈妈哪一个是爸爸是共就是很奇怪然后我们对比如说一些很简单的东西比如说生和死也觉得自己啊我知道什么是生我知道什么是死有生就无没死没生就然后其实他刚刚讲到的 很有意思因为你会发现其实你不知道生和死之间的这条线到底在哪里他刚举的就是那些比如说我死了可是我想对我被冷冻我想我以后可能会有新的技术把我弄活所以我想先被冷冻然后再过一百年有人可以把我弄活那我在这个冷冻的这个箱子里面我是活的还是死的 如果有人比如说想继承如果我是活的话他就不能继承我的东西我的孩子也不能继承虽然我在一个冰箱里面有很多这种问题他也谈到了很多其他的问题所以新科技给我们这些就是我们感觉最清楚的这些东西都已经变成很模糊了那么你想想看我们现在已经觉得模糊的东西是多么的模糊 所以对，然后我们也说到了privacy，就是这个东西，然后就是他也说到了很多新科技可以会带来的问题，然后我们怎么可以，比如说在一个公司里面或者政府怎么可以沟通，然后沟通的时候不被人家，人家不能懂我们在说什么，所以他也在这�方面想了很多。
Let me go on to the ways in which these technologies, in particular the internet, encryption, and related technologies, affect the possibilities for doing business online. What we do not yet have, but I expect eventually will have, is a fully anonymous digital currency, an e-cash. A Dutch cryptographer by the name of David Chaum figured out several decades ago how you could do such a thing. How you could have something where I can make a payment to you, where I do not have to know who you are, you do not have to know who I am, and the bank that ultimately holds the money never has to know who either of us is. Now that may sound exotic, but of course we can do that today. All we have to do is to mail paper money to people. All right. When I pay somebody with paper money, he doesn't have to know me, I don't have to know him, and if there's a bank that issues the money, they don't have to know either of us. But it turns out that there are ways in which that could be done where there is no physical object, but only a message going across across the internet. And if that comes into existence, I should say Bitcoin is a digital currency, but it is not an anonymous digital currency. In fact, in an odd sense, it's the least anonymous currency that has ever existed in the history of the world, because every transaction is public information to everybody who uses Bitcoin. Now, there may be ways of making it anonymous, but that requires additional efforts. But suppose we've got an anonymous digital cash, a Chaumian digital cash. One result is that money laundering laws, people know the term, laws which try to prevent things the government doesn't like by watching the flow of money. So if you are selling illegal drugs, you make money, you put the money in the bank, the government tries to find out and then seizes the money if you did that. Those laws become unenforceable once there is an anonymous digital cash, because you can now make transactions that nobody can see. But there's a downside to that, because it also means that if you kidnap somebody's child and hold him for ransom, you can demand the ransom in anonymous digital cash, and now there is no way to catch you collecting the ransom. If you think about things like kidnapping, the hardest part really for the kidnapper is collecting money without getting caught. Unfortunately, we can solve that problem. So, like most of these things, they've got good and bad consequences, and what I'm really talking about is not whether you should like them, but understanding what are the ways in which technological change can change the world. Another area of business online, if you are dealing with someone and you don't know who he is, it is very hard to sue him in a court. Even if you know who he is, since the internet national boundaries are transparent, and it's a lot of trouble if you live in China to sue somebody in India or Africa or America. So the standard legal system for enforcing contracts, except for large firms who have lots of lawyers, doesn't work very well online. But there is an alternative system that has always existed, and that's the use of reputation rather than courts. That if people want to stay in business, other people have to trust them. So a lot of the way in which people are actually made to keep their contracts is the fear that if they don't, other people will find out and stop dealing with them. And at the same time that the internet makes it harder to use courts, it makes it much easier to spread information, because the internet is a wonderful technology for information. eBay already does it. Amazon already does it. They aren't very fancy ways, but when you buy something on eBay, you get to make a report on the seller. When you buy something on Amazon, you get to review it. All of these are reasons to make firms keep their promises for fear that otherwise people will discover they shouldn't be trusted. Now, there are fancier ways of using the technology, which I don't think I'm going to go into now because I've only got a limited amount to talk. But there are ways of making it very easy when you have broken a contract with me for me to prove to him that you did it. And it involves arbitrators and digital signatures, and I'm not going to say more than that at the moment, but if you look at the stuff on my webpage, you can find it. Biotech. I like to say that the stealth reproductive technology, the one that is already fully implemented but that nobody has noticed, is paternity testing. That it is a say, I don't know if it's a saying in Chinese, the saying in English, it's a wise child that knows his father. All right? The mother, you know, you came out of her body. The father is speculation. If you think about human mating institutions, that fact is responsible for a lot of how human institutions are arranged. Why is it that in almost all human societies, mating is arranged such that only one man has sexual access to a woman? Because that's the only way the man can know which children are his. All right? And that has been true as long as there have been humans. It's not true anymore. It doesn't take a wise child. It only takes a good lamb. All right? So that means that it is at least possible. I don't know what will happen, but it is possible that human mating institutions will eventually change in ways which no longer depend on male sexual jealousy. Maybe not. Maybe male sexual jealousy is hardwired. Maybe it's just built in. Maybe it isn't. We'll find out. But you could have patterns in which the connection of parents only happens when the child is born and you then find out who it is. Let me take another one, a particularly attractive and interesting one. And that is the idea that we could use technology to choose from among the children I and my wife could have which one we do have. All right? I've got a lot of genes. She's got a lot of genes. It should become possible to pick the sperm of mine that does not carry my bad heart, but does carry my mathematical ability. The egg of hers that does not carry her poor circulation and her tendency to get wobbly if she doesn't eat for 6 hours, but does carry her intelligence and benevolence and all of the things that make her a wonderful person. Combine those two and we get the perfect child. Now, it's true we've done it twice, but we did it by pure luck. Anyway, but it looked, for people who are sufficiently curious, there is an early science fiction novel by Robert Heinlein called Beyond This Horizon, in which he sketches out a technology by which it could be done. That all you, the early version of it, which can now be done, is that you do in vitro fertilization. You fertilize an egg outside of the woman's body. You then wait until it comes to the 8-cell part. It divides and divides and divides. You take out one cell and you test it to see if it has a gene for something you really don't want. If you imagine that one of the parents is carrying some very serious heritable disease and you want to eliminate that. That we can do now. But that's very clumsy, because we're only getting at it after the egg has been fertilized. And there ought to be a way in which you could choose from among the sperms which ones you use, from among the eggs which one you use, and thus get much closer to being able to create the child that's still your child, but the one of your children that has your good features and doesn't have your bad features. So that would be a very powerful one. Now, it may have occurred to you that everybody in this room is dying of an incurable disease. It's called old age. Some of us are farther away along than some of you. But so far, it's gotten everybody. On the other hand, we know immensely more about biology and medicine than we did 100 years ago. 100 years ago, for most illnesses, the only thing an honest doctor could do was to tell you whether it would kill you or not. It was not until the antibiotics and the sulfa drugs before, but there were a set of medicines that were invented starting in the 1920s, which were the first time when, from most diseases, you could give someone a medicine that did any good. There were a few exceptions, but prior to about 1900, all doctors either were largely frauds or could only do a very few things other than giving you advice. There were a few exceptions. They could set bones, for example. But most diseases we could not cure until the 20th century. Given how fast things are changing, it may well be that we will find a cure to the disease that's killing all of us. Probably not in time for me, but quite likely in time for many of you. All right? It's worth thinking about what that world will be like. Think about a world where people don't get old. Maybe even where old people can be young again if we get good enough at it. What would you do? All right, imagine that you're 50 or 60, and they suddenly change things so that you no longer get old. Maybe you're back down to 30 or 40. Do you continue with your present job forever? Do you say, well, that was very interesting, but I've always wanted to be a novelist, so I'm going to give up on what I've been doing and write novels instead? Or do something else? Or would you say, I really don't like working, so I'm going to work very hard for another decade or two and accumulate enough money so I can retire forever? Or maybe the one that I like best is you retire, you make enough money so you can retire on a sort of a very minimal standard forever, and you then only take the jobs you like. But the more general point is, think about that world. It also has some unattractive features. After all, if that world, if we had solved aging 100 years ago, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it would have been ruled by Joseph Stalin equipped with nuclear weapons. If that had happened 100 years ago, Franco would still rule Spain. Someone else would still rule China. So it's not a wholly good thing. There is the argument that says the only way that science changes is old scientists die, and then the new ideas get through. It's a very positive thing for me because I don't want to die, but it's a mixed thing for what the world would be like. Nanotech. How many people are familiar with the term nanotechnology? Some, but not a lot. Everything that human beings make, including this, is engineered at a very, very coarse scale. If you think about the little tiny things inside of a computer, still have trillions of atoms or quadrillions of atoms in them. We ourselves are engineered at the atomic scale. If you think about how DNA works or how other parts of your internal body work, you have what are essentially machines that are a single molecule. Suppose we learn how to build on that scale. If you imagine designing machines at the level of single atoms, so that a machine is in effect a molecule, a lot of atoms stuck together, what is the first thing that you do if you are able to engineer at that scale? And the first thing you try to do is to build an assembler. What's an assembler? An assembler is a nanotech scale factory for building nanotech devices. It's a machine where you can give it instructions and it'll stick atoms together. Remember that from the scale of nanotech, the world looks like a whole lot of identical pieces called atoms. There are only, about 90 or so that you actually are likely to see. So I think of it as a world of very small Legos. Do people play with Legos in China? Yeah. You know what Legos are. So imagine your atoms as Legos, and building anything is just pulling out Legos and sticking them together. So what do? You build a general purpose assembler. That's going to be very hard. But it's a little robot machine that can pull out atoms and put them together any way you like. And once you have an assembler, what's the first thing you tell it to build? Another assembler. A copy of itself. And what do you do with the two assemblers? You give them some atoms and you have four assemblers. And what do you do with the four assemblers? You have eight assemblers. 10 doublings, you have 1,000. 20 doublings, you have 1,000,000. 30 doublings, you have 1,000,000,000. Now you build stuff. All right, so it's very much like biology, of course. After all, that's the way we do it too, right? Living creatures create copies, not exact copies, but copies of themselves, and this could be exact copies. So nanotech is potentially a very, very powerful technology, and it is, like most powerful technologies, powerful for good and for evil. One very simple example that somebody has worked out is a nanotech red blood cell. The red blood cells are the part of your blood that carries oxygen. And the idea is that what a red blood cell really is an oxygen tank. It's a biological oxygen tank. You can make, if you had an assembler, you can design a nanotech oxygen tank the same size that holds much, much, much more oxygen. All right? So you imagine you have a heart attack. You call up your doctor and you make an appointment. You have 3 hours before you die because there's enough oxygen in your bloodstream to keep you alive for another 3 hours because some of your red blood cells are not red blood cells. Let me take a more extreme example. Suppose you can build a cell repair machine. A cell repair machine is a little tiny submarine, much smaller than a cell, with a very, very, very small computer in it. And what does it do? It goes through your body fixing everything that's wrong. Now, you might say it will take a very long time to go through every cell in your body. You've got a couple of trillion of them. That's all right, because we're going to have 100 million cell repair machines in the pill you swallow. And they'll just set about their work fixing everything. That might be one way of solving aging, of course, if we could do that. But that's the solution. Your cell repair machine would solve not only aging, but everything. On the other hand, there is what people in the nanotech world refer to as the gray goo scenario. And the idea is that someone makes not a general purpose assembler, which is very complicated, but just a small nanotech device whose only function is making copies of itself. And it uses some easily available source of energy, such as the sun, and it can grab out atoms out of anything, and in about a week, it turns the entire world into gray goo, into copies of itself. All right, so that's the downside. A less extreme downside would be nanotech designer diseases, where you would make things like bacteria, only you've engineered them instead of growing them, which look for people who have certain genetics, for the kind of people who live in China if you're fighting a war against China. And so you kill a few of your own people too, but people who have wars don't mind that so much. Or maybe you do even better. Maybe you're an assassin and you could design your disease so there's only one person in the world who can catch it. All right. Again, if you think about the fact that biological systems are already engineered at the atomic scale, if you can engineer at the atomic scale, you can do a lot of the sorts of things they do. So what do you do about it? And I know some of the people who originally thought up these ideas, and they are people whose general political prejudice is against governments, and nonetheless, they think that perhaps nanotech is so dangerous that you need to have government regulations on its development to prevent either gray goo or various disease-damaging kinds of things. The problem with that, however, is that if you think about the world as it is, and you say a great deal of money goes into making medicines, into making drugs, into making cars safer, a great deal of money goes into killing people too. What kinds of organizations spend money trying to learn how to kill people?
Government.
Only governments, right? I suppose companies that make handguns a little bit, but almost all governments. So therefore, saying the solution to making nanotech safe is to say that government controls nanotech looks a little bit like setting the fox to guard the henhouse. And a more optimistic way of looking at it is to say, look, this is a very powerful technology which could be used in both offensive and defensive ways. You could design cell repair machines to defend you. You could design tailored diseases to kill people. On the market, there will be much more demand for defense than offense, that people don't want to die much more than they want to kill other people. Some people sometimes want to kill other people too, but it's a lower priority than living yourself. So that means that unless for some reason the offensive is much easier than the defensive, that we might expect that if we leave things alone, the defense of nanotech will develop faster and farther and stronger than the offensive, and if so, we might be all right. And there's a little bit of evidence, because as I said, biological systems are already designed at the nanotech level. They're already atomic scale. That's how living creatures work. There are already things out there trying to turn the world into copies of themselves. You, for example. Every living creature is the biotech equivalent of my Grey Goo, in the sense that every living creature, from viruses on up, is trying to make copies of itself. There are viruses and there are whales. So it doesn't look as though the offensive has such a large advantage over the defensive that my little Grey Goo things will defeat everybody else. So maybe we'll survive. Maybe not. I'm an optimist by nature. But in terms of technology, we simply do not know that there are technologies that could make things enormously better, enormously worse, enormously different. Artificial intelligence. What am I? You want to share?
所以他刚刚说到了很多东西，我会试探，就是很快的说一下，然后如果你没有问题，等一下在问答环节可以问我，和问，先生。Okay, so, 首先他提到了 doing business online, 就是说，在网上做交易，做生意，然后他就说。 如果科技会使我们可以不用人家知道我是谁，然后给有金钱的交换，但就说，比如说我可以签一个单子，然后把我的钱寄给另外一个人，而另外那个人不用知道我是谁，我是狗，是男的，是女的，还是我是一个人，还是一个电脑。 所以，这个肯定很好挣，对一些公司会很好。可是我们也要想到，就是他每次说到一件事，都会试试看想到好的那一方面，或坏的那一方面。所以，坏的那一方面就是，比如说，如果你孩子被绑架了，那些绑架的人，因为绑架最难的就是得到那些钱，可是不被抓到，是吧？那如果人家可以有一个方法。 完全是找不到你的方法，你还可以收钱，那你不是很舒服吗？那绑架就变得很简单了。所以，我们他想说的就是，我们的科技，我们的现在的发展会有好处，也会有坏处。我们他是一个很乐观的人，所以他觉得可能应该会越来越好。可是他说，从如果客观的来看的话，是很难说的。 然后我们说到了biotech，就是说生物科技。我们又说到了那些父母的问题，然后也说到了如果孩子，我们可以创，就我们可以不用自然的方法来创造一个孩子出来。比如说，我们可以选我们要他是。 要他有我们的哪一部分？比如说，如果你的太太有一个心脏病的可能性很高的话，你不要你的孩子有这一个病，所以你就不拿他的这一个基因，也可以。这是否这是个好事呢？现在听起来好像很好，可是他也会说到很多，就是如果你真正想起来去想的话，你会发现，如果我们可以。 用就是控制人类的基因，有时候会出很大的问题。然后第三点，我们就说到了 nanotech， 就是纳米技术。我们就也说到了，如果人不就是现在科技这么好，如果在五十年以后，我们找到了一种科技可以使人类不去世，永远就不死了，然后老人也可以又变年轻。 这会在你们的世界观，在你们生命里有多大的影响？如果你们不会病死了，出车祸还会出，但是病是不会被病死了。你会继续工作吗？你会继续现在很努力的工作吗？ 他说 有很多可能性，可能你会觉得，哦，那我在工作二十年赚很多钱，然后投资，然后我就可以退休个两百年，然后再来再工作二十年，再退休个两百年，可以吗？当然可以。你那如果你还可以生孩子，你还生吗？因为你知道你再过五百年可能你又想生了，那你再生一个，然后还是你和你的孙子玩，还是纯孙子，就是有很就是，如果这些东西发生了的话，我们的世界不仅仅是不会是同一个世界，可是我们感觉我们知道的东西会有一个就是完全的变化，然后这个变化是否是好是坏，你是否在这一个新的世界里想动，还是不想，还是想和以前一样，这是你的选择。可是他说这个新的世界的可能来的可能性比我们想象的会早，而不只是在电影然后科幻片里面会看到的一些问题。
What am I and what are you? I am not my hand. If I lost my hand, I would still be me. I am not my foot. I think what I am, though I'm not sure, is a computer program or a set of computer programs. I think what the human being is software running on the hardware of the brain. That could be wrong. But programs are more like conscious beings than anything else we've observed. And it would seem as though the brain is rather like a computer, and it is therefore a at least plausible guess that that's what people really are. Over time, computers get better, faster, more powerful. We learn more about how to think. How soon before we have computers that are as smart as we are? Raymond Kurzweil, who has been somebody who made a number of important breakthroughs, including the first good computer music machine and the first good reading machine, and has been interested in these things for a long time, estimated about 10 years ago that we had about 30 years before computers were as smart as we are. So if he's right, maybe it's another 20 years. That sounds very nice, and it would be an interesting world where we had intelligent creatures that weren't us. But there is a problem, because after 30 years, the computers keep getting smarter and we don't. In 40 years, we are gerbils. In 40 years, we are sharing the world with beings as much smarter as we are smarter than most animals. That's a slightly scary thought. And we'd better hope they like pets. Kurzweil's solution is that while these things are happening and we are learning more about minds and computers, we are developing better ways of linking our minds to our computers, with the result that more and more of our thinking is being done not outside of our heads. And a primitive version exists already. This is my external memory. That computer over there is my external memory. This machine, unlike me, knows exactly where I am because it's got a GPS built into it. And when that stopped working for a little while this morning, I really felt lost. So imagine that we keep going on to the point where what you have in your pocket is not a cell phone. It's a computer linked directly at high speed to your brain where you can shift some of the computing your brain is doing to that computer. With that system, as computers get smarter, we get smarter. So we end up in a world in which not only the computers are super geniuses, so are we. So that's, again, a very weird and science fictional picture, but it's not clear that it isn't one possible way that things could change. Virtual reality. The current version of virtual reality is World of Warcraft. The current world version of virtual reality is screens and speakers. And I eventually realized that that was actually a better version of virtual reality than I thought when I observed how much time I and other people were willing to spend in that world. Because the really high tech in the present system is not the computer and the speakers. The really high tech is the human imagination. Because after all, reading books was a form of virtual reality too. You could be there with Monkey battling his way to India with his steel needle that turned into a steel bar, even though he never existed. You could be Robinson Crusoe on his island. So there's a certain sense in which imagination always did it. And it turns out that if you add the prop of a screen and a speaker, it does it surprisingly well. But the next step is what I think of as deep VR. Because all of us have experienced full sense virtual reality. Some of us every night. We call it dreams. That in dreams, it seems as though things are really happening. So suppose we learn how to do it. Suppose we understand how dreams work, and we understand how to send signals to our own brain that create the illusion of whatever we want it to see. That's deep VR. You can then imagine a future world where, looked at in real space, it looks like a very poor world. Everybody occupies a little tiny cubicle with a comfortable bed and some exercise equipment. Everybody is eating soybeans. But the soybeans taste like filet mignon and ice cream and whatever else your favorite food is. Because taste is only sensation. It's only in your head. And if we have good enough VR, we can do everything in our head. Everybody is living in a tiny cubicle, but to you, you're living in a mansion on the Pacific coast. After all, lots of people in virtual reality spend their time living places that don't exist. If we get good enough at it, it'll feel just as real as reality. Is this heaven or hell? Robert Nozick has a version of that in one of his books, philosopher, libertarian philosopher. He imagines an experience machine. This is my VR. You plug, somebody plugs you into the experience machine, and the rest of your life is an illusion. And he says, suppose the person who has the machine can guarantee you an illusory life just a little better than your real life would be. All right. Somehow he knows what your life is going to be. And he knows that you'll do pretty well in your company. In the illusion, you're just a little bit better. He knows you'll have three nice kids. In the illusion, you have three nicer kids. Everything feels just a little bit better. Do you plug in? Would you substitute an illusion of a life for a real life? Right, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. But that's, in a sense, the same issue. But it's not entirely the same issue. Because some things in VR are real. I don't care whether you read my books in paper or on a screen. Because transmitting ideas is the same thing. It doesn't depend on physical reality. You might get to know somebody. I have friends I've never met who I've interacted with only online. So, it's a mix. Some of the things in virtual reality are just as real, they're just different. But others are fake. It matters that I have real children. I don't just want to have the illusion of having children. A couple of other things about virtual reality. One of them is virtual reality plus encryption gets us back the privacy we lost from surveillance technology. Because if we're living our lives entirely, what in effect sending computer messages back and forth, and if we can encrypt that, then the cameras have nothing to watch. There's nothing happening here. Nozick, in the final part of his book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, he described the utopia not as a single society, but as a world of many, many different societies where each person got to be in the one he liked. So that the people who want a very puritanical, restricted society get to live there. People who want to walk around nude and have sex with everybody get to live in that society. Everything in between. Virtual reality could give you Nozick's utopia. Because after all, you don't have to play World of Warcraft. You could be playing some other game. And you could imagine a future where there are people who create worlds, each of which is a world and a society designed for some particular set of people with particular tastes. So that gives you a very interesting possible future. Shall I stop now? Do you want to? No, keep going. I'll keep going. All right, let me go on to another one which I find a little bit scary, and that's what I think of as mind drugs. That we have long had drugs that affect the mind. There are three categories of mind drugs, I think. One of them is drugs for pleasure. Alcohol is that for many people, marijuana, heroin. Another is drugs for performance, drugs that let you do things better. Some people think if they have a drink before they do things, they'll be relaxed and it'll work better. Ritalin, which is used for ADHD, and Ritalin lets people on ADHD concentrate better. But it doesn't tell you if you have ADHD because Ritalin lets everybody concentrate better. And some people take it before exams. Steroids let athletes perform better. Control. One reason to drink is because you enjoy getting drunk. One reason is to relax yourself. And one reason to serve wine to a woman is the hopes of getting her to go to bed with you. So that one of the things alcohol is used for, has long been used for, is to try to make other people act in the way we want them to act. All right? So alcohol is an example of all my three categories. I sort of like that. But we're getting much better at drugs and much better at understanding the mind and how it works. So what happens when we have really good pleasure drugs? Larry Niven has some science fiction stories with a version of that. In his version, it's a wire that goes into your brain and stimulates the pleasure center. And a wire head can starve to death because it's too much trouble to get food if it means leaving the intense pleasure. All right? You could imagine, that's what people sometimes imagine with drugs. What about credulity drugs? Drugs that make you believe what people tell you. What about obedience drugs? Drugs that make you do what people tell you. How might we defend against that sort of thing? One solution is some way of testing before you drink anything what's in it. And there, in fact, exists some such tests for particular drugs people are worried about. Another, if we combine this with my nanotech revolution, is that I check my wrist and the little light, little LED on my wrist goes red if anything dangerous is in my bloodstream. And I then push a button and it filters it out again. Finally, you can imagine a legal response in which a contract is only binding if both parties had blood tests before they signed it to make sure they are not being influenced by some drug. All right, let me get to some conclusions. I'm about running out of time, I think, or have run out of time. The first one is that change can be very fast and very unpredictable, which is why mostly in my book, Future Imperfect, I limited myself to the next 30 years. Beyond that, I think the future fades. There are very serious ways in which the world could go wrong. I like to say that global warming is a pretty wimpy catastrophe. That if you look seriously at the predictions, not the rhetoric, but the science, what are they saying? They're saying that by the end of this century, sea level might have gone up by a foot or two. That's very small. It's a fraction of distance between high tide and low tide. By the end of the century, the temperature of the Earth might have gone up by 2 or 3 degrees. That's less than the difference between the northern and southern parts of my country. All right? Could have bad consequences. There are various bad things that could happen. But they're not really on the same scale as wiping out the human race. And I have three different ways the human race could wipe itself out in the next century. All right? Artificial intelligence. If we create computers that are smarter than we are and they decide they don't like us. Nanotech, gray goo. I haven't discussed the destructive biotech, but you can easily enough imagine designer diseases, which are designed not quite right and end up killing everyone instead of just the people they're supposed to kill. All right. On the other hand, as you can see from what I've said, the upside includes a world where everybody is brilliant and more or less immortal. So everything between that is within the range. And the reaction which some people have looking at these ideas is stop the train, I want to get off. We like the world as it is, and this is a very scary future. And my answer is that this train does not have brakes, and you are one of the reasons it does not have brakes. That is to say, think of any technology that might be scary. A single country might be able to block it. All right? You could imagine in a world which only consisted of the United States, that the United States might say, nanotech is too dangerous. We won't allow anyone to do research in nanotech. But nanotech is also enormously powerful and useful. If one country has nanotech and nobody else does, that country runs the world. There are a lot of countries out there. So unless all of them decide to stop a technology, if the technology is something that has very high positive possibilities, someone is going to do it. Now, I'm an optimist. I want this future, even though I see dangerous things in it. And from my standpoint, there are three very good things about China at the moment. One is it has become a sufficiently advanced country so it can do new things. It could develop nanotech, just as we could develop nanotech. The second is it is a country the U.S. cannot push around. And the third is that it is different. And because it's different, it will want to ban different things. And if everything is banned by either America or China, but not by both of them, then nothing is banned. All right? So from my standpoint, that was one of the reasons I thought this was an appropriate talk to give here, because if you like the idea of technology continuing to develop, and you, of course, want to try to, as best you can, get the good parts and not the bad parts, then China is an interesting and important place. Let me say a few words as an economist about how it's possible for progress to make us worse off. Because your sort of first instinct ought to be, it's good to learn more to do more things, no problem. The obvious answer is, my being able to do more is good for me, but it might be bad for you, and your being able to do more might be bad for me because you might do things to me. For example, I've discussed some of them. But let me give you a more precise answer from the economist's standpoint. All societies face a problem economists call the coordination problem, which is that to accomplish anything, many, many people have to cooperate. Somebody has to mine the ore. Someone has to refine it into steel. Someone has to turn the steel into a chainsaw. Someone has to make gasoline for the chainsaw. Someone has to cut down the tree. And now we have the wood to make a pencil. And that's only one little piece of the chain of people to make a pencil, which is a very simple thing. All right. So you need some way of coordinating it. And there are only two answers to that problem, and one of them doesn't work. And the obvious answer, which is the one that doesn't work, is central coordination. The obvious answer is someone sits up at the top and he says, you mine some ore, you turn it into steel, you build a chainsaw, you do this, you do that. And the experiment has been tried. That's one reason that the Soviet Union was a failure. And I think economists understand why that is a much, much harder problem than it looks. The other solution, the one that does work, is some sort of decentralized coordination. And the basic simple model for that is private property and trade, with each person solving a little piece of the problem dealing with him. So everything belongs to somebody. I get to control my stuff. If I want to use your stuff, I've got to make you an offer you're willing to accept. If I want you to help me with something, I've got to find a way in which I can help you with something. And that system, unlike centralized control, scales. When the society gets twice as big, it still works. However, for that to work, we need some way of dividing up the world into pieces, which we call property, such that what I do mostly affects my piece and what you do mostly affects your piece. If what I do affects a million people's pieces, it's going to be really hard for any coordination to work that involves our agreeing to do things. All right? We can handle small-scale violations, small-scale my thing affects you, by contract. That you want me to write a book, fine, I'll write the book, you pay me for it. We can handle some other things by tort law, by saying, when I drive, there's a small effect that my car will run into your car and dent it. If so, I owe you damages. But the farther we get away from a world where I can control my stuff and you can control your stuff and it doesn't affect each other, the harder it is for the decentralized system to work. Technological progress makes us more powerful. That might mean that the things we do have longer range effects. All right? If so, it's going to be harder to define the world in such a way that my stuff affects me and your stuff affects you. Firework displays are a lot of fun. As it is, they're a little bit of a problem. Suppose we did them with nuclear weapons. It's really hard to have a nuclear fireworks display on my property that doesn't bother my neighbors, or even people downwind 100 miles away. And that you can think of as a metaphor for the fact that getting more powerful sometimes makes it harder to solve the problem. And then the world disappears. No solutions. All right? So we might end up going down from one solution to none. On the other hand, technological progress also makes it easier to control things, easier for it to observe so you know what's happening, so I know that I owe you damages. You can use computers to negotiate more complicated contracts than people can. We can protect ourselves against injuries with higher technology. The Taylor diseases are no problem if I've got cell repair machines running through my body fixing anything that goes wrong. And even nuclear fireworks shows are no problem, oops, in virtual reality, but the damn Windows computer has messed up my display. I am going to fix this right now. There are some things up with which I will not put. And Windows computers ruining my show is one of them. There we are. That was my punchline, which it didn't want to show you. Oops, sorry. My website is www.daviddfriedman.com. A majority of my books are readable in full text there. Most of my published articles are readable there. The chapters of the book I'm writing are readable there as drafts. The new chapters of my first book, which the third edition of which hasn't come out yet, can be read there. A lot of my talks, I've got links to recordings of my talks. So there's all sorts of stuff, if you find this interesting, on many different topics. I've only been talking about one topic out of many. And I have a blog which you can only read if you have access to a proxy server, because it's blocked, as I discovered when I tried to read it here, at least at the moment. But I call my blog Ideas, and it's about everything. So now I will sit down and you get to ask questions.
Let me just translate the last part.
Sure.
If you want, can I have a minute?
Sorry.
Okay, so 我很快的总结一下，最后一部分，然后我们就可能休息数分钟，然后就问一些问题，好吗？所以我们刚刚说到了人工智能，也说到了虚伪的现实，说到了很多又是问题，然后也有好处。我们刚刚已经说过了，它是给很多很多不同的例子。然后它最后总结是说，现在的变化会很非常快，你们要准备好，因为这些变化会来得比你们所想的快得多。我们一般会讲到什么？要环保，因为再过三十年，可能地球的温度会加暖一两度什么的。可是他觉得真正的问题其实就是这些科技的发展，因为再过三十年，如果人已经创造出了一个可以毁灭自己的一个武器或者一个科技的话，那地球的温度高一两度其实也不是个太大的问题，我们也 比如说然后他就举了一些例子，比如说如果人工智能的话，我们可以已经可以创造出一些机器人，机器人比我们还聪明，跑得快，跳得高，力量大的话，那最后我们就变成机器人的奴隶，那其实 global warming 已经不是个太大的问题了。所以他说他一般讲到这个地方的时候，一般的人就会觉得啊，等一下，我们好像有点到了一个科幻的世界里面。如果你刚跟我说这个在将来的三十年会出现的话，我可能不想要有这些变化，我可能想就是在我们现在的世界里活得好好的，也很开心。但他说这是不可能的，你不可能，现在世界不可能持久。中国就是他来的这个国家，也就是一个就是这个世界不可能持久的原因。为什么中国很特别？有三点。第一点就是中国现在已经可以就是有潜力很大，然后现在中国已经可以和美国比了。然后第二点，为什么中国呢？因为中国又有潜力，又不会被美国停住。因为比如说我们可以想到法国或者英国，其实也是很有潜力的国家，可是因为美国会给他们很大的压力，他们可能做的事会顺从美国的意见，而中国不会，所以这是为什么中国很重要。第三点就是他说，如果在世界里有一个国家不禁止他的研究，比如说人工智能，如果美国想停止了，因为他发现如果我们继续下去，可能人类会被毁灭，而中国看到一个很好的利益的关系，不要停止这个technology 的话，那么可能这个 technology 的 development 的，可能这个科技的发展不会停止。如果中国不要停止，除非一个科技美国和中国两个一起停止的话，这个科技的发展会继续下去，然后继续下去的后果会有很多，他也为了每一个东西都介绍了一个后果，一个好的后果，一个不好的后果。所以他就说这是为什么他来到了中国，想看一下这个很有潜力的国家，不会被美国控制的国家。
其实 Freeman 教授所讲的一些就是科技的一些就是进展对于我们的未来世界是产生怎样影响，我这里稍微做一个小的总结。首先就是其实有两个点，就是 good points and bad points， 就是好的地方就是为我们人类的进步做出很多的贡献，包括我们的生物科技，它能够治疗一些疾病，包括就是修改我们比较坏的基因，就是选择优质基因之类的，或者是一些先进的科技，交通或之类的便利我们的生活。但是也有一些就是不好的方面，科技的太大的一个进展造成了一些，毕竟我们的世界不是仅仅是一个国家，有很多国家，造成一些就是利益上的冲突，来就是损害我们的一个就是和平，就是一些比方说就是 nuclear weapon， 就是核武器之类的，去损害整个世界。那中间的衡量是怎样？这个未来的话，我们科技当然一定要进展，但是 Friedman 教授的话，他保持一个乐观的心态，因为他是一个乐观主义者，他觉得今后的生活，我们的科技的发展总是会改善人类的生活为目的而发展的，而并不是就是以那种破坏性的一个理念。但是呢，谁知道今后的世界是怎样子？这就是我就是刚才看到这些就是 PowerPoint 还有 Friedman 教授的都是会有个小总结。Do you need a break time?
No, I just want to see if you can answer your question. Sure.
在那个 Q&A 之前，我跟大家解释一下，就是弗里德曼教授呢，他是一个杂家，他其实大家觉得他是一个机器学家，但其实他也是一个教法学的教授。那他同时他的课题呢，就是他博士，他是其实是读的物理学。那其实我觉得我跟他相处这几天以来， 一个很大的一个感受，就是他从来不给自己的思维设任何的限制，他总是对他看到的一切他都 很感兴趣，都很好奇他到底是为什么。所以这个课题呢是我选的，就是未知的，就是不完美的未来。但实际上大家这个课题主要是一些他都会对未来的一些想法，当然都很有趣。那可能大家应该还知道，弗里德曼教授呢是一位那个芝加哥学派的一个经济学家，也是那个无政府自由和无政府资本主义的一个重要的一个理论家，可能会大家会对这两块非常感兴趣。待会儿在 Q&A 的环节，就是不限于今天的这个话题，而是说你对任何想感兴趣的话题，你都可以提问。
好吧，问题，这位先生。
Good afternoon. I have two questions. First of all, is how can the Chinese citizen value in the new value?
The first question is how can the Chinese citizens' wealth increase in value?
The Chinese citizens' what?
Increasing the inflation.
Wealth? Increase in.
The question is do you think that the RMB will become a global currency in the next 10 years? And if yes, what would be the impact of the change? Yeah.
I have no idea whether the RMB will become a global currency. I have no expertise on that subject at all. Back before I was an economist, I was briefly a physicist before I changed fields. And I feel that your question is like asking a random physicist how to build an atomic bomb. That building atomic bombs is something physicists do that seems very interesting to people, but very few physicists do it. And predicting what will happen in the world economy is not what I do. That economics, as I understand it, is a way of understanding behavior that starts from the assumption that people have objectives and tend to take the actions that achieve them, what economists call rationality. And my interest is in applying that approach to understanding as many things as I can. So I am not an expert on employment. I am not an expert on GNP. I am not an expert on current monetary systems. And I regard the legal system of Iceland 1,000 years ago as just as interesting as the legal system of America or China today. That they are all examples of things to be understood.
Okay, 所以问的问题就是RMB 会不会就是人民币会不会变成一个国际的一个货币？他说他不知道，因为很多原因。
The author Henry nominated me and her.
No.
The story is about a guy in your age, right? Just went through a bad marriage and had a very long life. And one day he bought an operating system, computer operating system, which can self-learn and self-evolve. So gradually he fell in love. Is that operating system?
Yes.
And the story ends very sadly. The computer system cheated. While talking to him, she was also talking to another 800 guy at the same time.
Yes.
Also, she was very sad. Is that the future we're heading? I don't want to be in that future. So, what's your take on that?
Sure. I think my first take is he shouldn't have been jealous. that is, I haven't seen the movie, but versions of the idea of programmed computers that people get emotionally involved with have been around for a long time in science fiction. But it seems to me the real lesson is that if you have artificial intelligence, it will be people very different from us. And the fact that you could have a person who was simultaneously conducting real conversations with 800 people, it seems weird to us. But since, assuming that it's got the processing power, it doesn't have to stop paying attention to you just because it's paying attention to 799 other people. So I would say that that would be an interesting world in which there were people who were that different in lots of, and there'd be other ways they could be different, but it is the best in his life. That is, I'm assuming that the program is really a nice person. Maybe not. That is, there's no particular reason why it can, there's no particular reason why a computer program couldn't be a real person with real feelings and real thoughts and real conversation. And if it was, you might eventually stop noticing that it was a program. Then I'm reminded of something which in an odd, which seems very different, but in an odd way isn't. Many years ago, I spent a summer in Canberra, Australia, visiting at the Australian National University. And in the building I was in, there was a man who I think must have been in a fire. His face was horribly scarred, so that the first time I looked at him, I wanted to look away. I got into a conversation with him, and the effect vanished. That once I was seeing him as a person, rather than as a grotesque mask, as it were, the fact that his face looked strange just didn't matter very much. And I think in the same sense, that if it turns out that the computer program really is a nice person. Now, of course, the program shouldn't have lied to him. The program shouldn't have pretended it was talking to nobody else.
He never asked.
Well, maybe that was his fault, that is, he should. Why? But that just means, yeah, but that doesn't happen. You know, people do that. People die too, unfortunately. There's no reason that has to happen. Right. Indeed, computers are probably a better candidate for living forever than we are. Yeah?
I have a 1-year-old daughter.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And my question is,
she'll get even cuter at 2.
I'm looking forward to it.
I've done the experiment.
And I think I share your vision of the future. And my question is, how should I prepare her for it?
That's a good question. This could get into a long discussion of education. Because I think the model that at least in my country almost everyone uses is crazy. And that the model assumes, I'm talking about K-12 education, up to age 18 roughly. And the standard model assumes that out of all of the world's knowledge, there is some piece of it, just the right size to fill K-12, that everybody should pretend to learn. And that's crazy, because there are a few things like how to read that almost everybody needs. And then there are a million things that are worth knowing, and you can only learn 100 of them. And so I think the right policy for education is not to say, here is the list of things you will learn today, but to say, what things out there that I've told you about sound interesting, I will help you learn about them. So that what you want to produce is not somebody who is an expert in a particular field, but somebody who is used to educating herself. That when my daughter went to college, two of the things that disturbed her about the college were that when a class was canceled, all the other students were happy. Why were they there? Why were they paying money if they didn't want to learn what was being taught? And second, that she was being expected to write essays that would only be read by one person ever, and only because it was his job to read it. That's fake. That's not the real world. And it happened that the college she was going to at the time had a 1 month winter term in which you could do your own project. And you didn't have to stay at school to do it. My daughter ended up majoring in Italian. One of my and my wife's hobbies is cooking from very old cookbooks. So for a winter term of her second year, our daughter came home and translated a 15th century Italian cookbook that nobody had ever translated before. And I put it up on the web. I think that maybe is an answer.
Technology actually has alienated people because we've got experience when we get together and everyone is affected with mental health complaints. People love communicating with each other in cyberspace. It's totally different from communicating in real life. For example, I've got a lot of friends on WeChat, but we're in trouble. I don't expect that I can get a lot of help from them. What's your take on it? And also, from you, do you think that GM food is dangerous? Do you think, is it just people are too wimpy, just like people are too much concerned about global warming, but in the end, it's just much to do about nothing?
Let me have the microphone. To start with the easy question, as far as I can tell, there are no problems with genetically modified food. As you may know, almost nothing you eat is natural. That with very few exceptions, all common foodstuffs are the result of selective breeding over a very long period of time. So that the way maize, what we call corn, started out as a weed you would not see as food. A couple of thousand years, I think took that long, of the combination of random mutation plus selecting the ones that had big grains on them gave us what we now eat. So I don't see that when you do it deliberately, it's going to be any less, say, any more dangerous than when you do it through random change and selection. But going back to your other question, as it happens, I got an email either today or yesterday from somebody who I had never met, who I have been talking with and arguing with online for probably 10 years or longer. And the email said that his cancer had stopped regressing and he thought he was dying. And since he knew I was taking a trip in that direction, would it be convenient for me to stop and visit? And I expect I will. So I think as far as I can see, my friendships with people online can be just as real. Depends on the particular friendship. Most of my daughter's friends are people she met in World of Warcraft. At least two of them have visited. One of them was visiting with us not very long ago. She spent a week in Chile to visit a couple of her online friends a few years ago. So as far as I can tell, I think it's just that you know, the new things always seem worse, as it were. Let me make a different digression, but it's maybe relevant. And that is that there's a tendency, at least in Western and maybe Chinese, I don't know, talk, to idealize sort of the old days of the family farm and people living with nature. And what we observe in country after country over the past few hundred years is that when it finally became possible to leave the rural area and still live, almost everyone did. That living out, you know, it looks very nice, but living in a world where you're interacting with 12 different people, maybe 20 if you're lucky, instead of a world where you can pick your friends among 100,000 and where your only entertainment is, you know, arguing with your neighbor all the time or watching the rice grow or something, it seems to me that it turns out that people really do like cities much better
and that's why there are 20 million people in Shanghai at this point. So no, I think on the whole that I don't think social changes are on net bad. Some of them might be. There are certainly bad effects. That something I didn't discuss because it's past technology is I think there are reasons why marriage is less stable than it was 100 years ago. And sometimes that's a good thing because some marriages are bad marriages, but often it's a bad thing. I'm not saying that everything is good. But no, as far as I can tell, it seems to me that online interaction is still interaction. You're still, you know, talking with people, even seeing them if you feel like it. Skype will let you video call if you like. So anyway, I guess that would be my opinion at least, is no, I don't think it's destroying human society.
Going back to your topic that you were talking about, forecasting the future, of course that's always a very challenging thing to do, and getting the timing right has been harder, and I always remember that old statement of Ayn Rand about it's earlier than you think. If you think back to the 1950s, Mises pointed out that socialism is very hard, and there tends to be basically no middle way. And that a little bit of socialism tends to lead to more, and eventually the economy hits the wall. And I know back in the 1950s, a lot of people in the U.S. felt that this wall was not very far away. Of course, China actually did hit that wall, and a much freer society emerged on the other side. What I'm interested to know is, in this context, if you think back to what your mindset was when you were writing The Machinery of Freedom, and you discussed the mechanics of a libertarian society, and that was back in the 70s, I think you were a little bit in the 80s.
I wrote the book about 1971 or 70. It was published in 72.
Right, and you were, I think, a few more chapters and later on in your vision.
Yep.
So I'd be really interested to know, if you think back to what your analysis was back then of how you saw the future, what actually worked out as expected and what turned out differently, and how have your thoughts changed since then?
It's hard for me to go back that far, that is to remember things from 40 years ago. Certainly since then I've made some mistakes. I thought that we would have anonymous e-cash by now, and we don't. We've got Bitcoin, which is a weird sort of bastard cousin of anonymous e-cash, and maybe it'll work. But I don't think that I either predicted or was astonished by the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I did have a discussion of creeping capitalism in The Machinery of Freedom, because, of course, China is precisely the mirror image of what you were saying from Mises, that I've just been reading the book that Coase co-authored about what happened in China. And his basic story is it wasn't that the people running the Communist Party woke up after Mao died and said, we were wrong, socialism is a mistake, we need capitalism. That what happened after Mao died was the people said, something has gone terribly wrong. We know we have the right system. We know socialism is right. But we must have made a mistake in our socialism somehow because we've done so badly. So let's try some other things. And let's let reality teach us, as it were. And as far as I can tell, at each step, they thought they were still socialists. But capitalism also has a tendency to spread. You have a little capitalism here and a little capitalism there, and I haven't yet decided whether China is more or less capitalist than the United States at the moment. I think it's an open question because it's less in some ways and more in others. So I'm not sure I can answer much beyond that.
Well, particularly in terms of the way things have worked out in the United States.
The United States has continued. The answer is that like everything, the United States is going in both directions at once. Intellectually, we are winning. That intellectually, the views that were the orthodoxy when I was in college are still orthodoxy in the kind of elite liberal arts college that rich kids go to, but they are not the orthodoxy for the majority of the population. That when Bill Clinton said that we're at the end of the age of big government, it wasn't true, but the fact that he said it meant that that's what people wanted to hear. At the same time, the U.S. government has gradually gotten somewhat bigger and somewhat more obtrusive. Not in all ways. Things are getting better in a few ways. It looks as though marijuana is getting legalized within a couple of years, I would guess. And some bad government things have stopped. Part of the problem is that there are, in a sense, always new battles. You mentioned Ayn Rand. I don't know if you've read J.R.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. But there's a wonderful line at the end of that where somebody is basically saying that no wars are ever won forever, that there will always be new threats and new problems. And in this case, the old argument for government intervention was essentially socialism. In America now, let me forget about China. They didn't call it that, but the argument was that the market by itself didn't work very well, and you needed the government to step in a bunch of ways to fix it. And that argument became less and less convincing, partly because the Soviet Union collapsed, partly because Singapore and Hong Kong and Taiwan and South Korea did so well, and in general, and partly because of ideas, because various people offered ideas suggesting that, in fact, the socialist argument was wrong. But there are still people who want to control things. And so now you have environmentalism as a new set of arguments for the same kind of conclusion, for saying that the government has to control this and that. Sometimes they're good arguments. There can be good arguments even for conclusions I don't like. But I've been encouraged by how unpersuaded the mass of the population has been by the global warming argument in the U.S., that you've got a situation where all of the elite is saying this is a terrible problem which is going to destroy us. It's a lie. It is a problem. It might even be a serious problem. But if you... I've read various bits and pieces of the latest IPCC report. And what's striking about that is the contrast between the rhetoric in the summary for policymakers and the actual content in the scientific articles. How many people know that the IPCC no longer claims that global warming causes drought? The fourth report made that claim. The fifth report retracted that claim. They do not claim that global warming causes hurricanes. The current report says that they do not think it does, and at least mild levels further they don't expect would do it. How many people realize that the sea level rise people are talking about is something between that and that? All right? The Dutch farmed land below high tide with the technology of 500 years ago. The idea that you cannot defend against sea level rise of 2 feet if you've got 80 years to get ready is just crazy. So it's true that there are going to be bad things and there are going to be good things. And it might be true that the bad things are worse than the good things, are more than the good things. We don't know. But as a sort of imminent catastrophe, it's a wet firecracker. And that's the reaction it's getting, that the newspapers and the sort of everybody important keep saying this over and over, and they keep saying, why is nobody listening? And I smile when they say that. Yeah.
My feeling of your speech and of the century is, yes, we are getting smarter and smarter, but we are getting away and away from the Eden, from the real happiness, the true happiness in our heart. So I think our people, our human being, will getting more and more mental disease in this century, and I feel truly sad about it. So I want to know, what do you think of this question, and what do you think of what do you do getting back to yourself, and what's your suggestion to all these people in this room to do to face the century. Thank you very much.
To begin with, I'm not sure if we are getting smarter. That's not entirely clear. There have been very smart people in the past. But oddly enough, I was thinking, I think it was either today or yesterday, about what I would like to have to be able to answer your question. And what I would like to have is for reincarnation to be real and to have somebody who had all his memories. Because we do not know what it was like to be somebody in the Han Dynasty, to be a peasant or to be a magistrate or anything in between. We do not know what it was like to live in the Roman Empire or to live in England in the 16th century. And wouldn't it be wonderful if there was someone who had actually lived in all of those times and could look at his memories and say, yes, I was happy then, no, I was unhappy now. But as it is, it's very, very hard to tell. And it's always been true, I think, that some people have said the golden age was in the past. It's gotten bad now. The things we can measure have gotten better. That in terms of real income, of our ability to control stuff, the average of the world is estimated to be about 10 times what it was through most of history. So that we are enormously richer than people until the last century or so. Are we less happy? I don't know. And I don't know how you can know. You can read books, you can read autobiographies, you can try to figure out what those people were like, and mostly when I read things written in the past, my impression is they were rather like us. And, you know, some of them were unhappy and some of them were happy. My two best 18th century sources are the memoirs of Casanova and the diaries of Boswell. And Boswell sounds like a rather unhappy person who probably didn't make other people very happy. And Casanova sounds like someone who really enjoyed life. And, you know, they lived at the same time in different places. So, but I guess the answer, what do you do? I suppose we've already had the answer to that. Have a one-year-old. And that will at least help you to have a meaningful life, because children are very intensely real. There, I feel as though in an odd way, parental love and romantic love have a lot in common. That in both cases you get the illusion that this one person is more important than everything else. And it can't be true, and yet you know it is true. And it's true when you're in love with a woman, if you're a man, or a man if you're a woman, and it's true with your own children, because, you know, they just matter so much. So that would be one thing to do. But I guess beyond that, you know, try to think. One way I put it is, what do you have to do to die happy? What sorts of things do you feel? And I think I know the answer. I've got to create ideas. I've got to create hopefully new and correct ideas if I'm lucky. But that's sort of what matters. A lot of other things I want to do too. I want to bring up my children. I've done that now. I got two grandchildren. So, a different way of putting it is to say, how do you pay rent for the chunk of the universe you're sitting in? And it's a sort of an intuition. What do you think is worth doing that you can do? But that's going to be a different answer for every person. I mean, it's not. I mean, I believe in decentralized coordination, and that includes the fact that I can't tell you what you have to do to die happy, and you can't tell me what I have to do. I hope that helps. But.
Hi. I had three things that I wanted to ask about your opinion on. I'm looking at the world as a big picture kind of thing. I'm that type of person. I don't focus on one thing. I look at the big picture and how it affects everything. So I'm a musician. I've done acting. I've done anything that I wanted to. So people say that's a, Renaissance kind of person. I draw, I paint, I teach, I philosopher. But what I saw in music, being in that industry at a young age, starting at 12, and professionally, was the record labels. We chase, and knocked on their doors, EPs, records, you know, trying to get the signature, to get the contract, to get to tour, you know, promote the albums. And then along comes Napster, this kid in college, just makes the program, shares, and boom, the whole record industry within 3 to 5 years is done. They're done. There's no more record industry. They're there, but they're not. You can go online, you can download free, 99 cents. It's changed. And that's what I'm about. I've been raised overseas, all over the world, as at a young age. So I'm a person that sees change all the time. So Napster changed the music industry of what was set. And people say, oh, this is set. No matter what, it's not going to change. But it changed. The next industry is movies, acting. I did that for 5 years after quitting banking in Citibank. I was a district area manager of 4 branches in L.A. And I just said, I'm done. And went into acting. And it was easy. Every day I was working. Movies, TV shows. But in that industry, the same thing I see happening that happened with Napster. I have YouTube. And I'm starting to see people with a small budget, maybe $5,000, can make the exact same or best quality, good enough quality, the same as the movies you see in the theater with the software and different things like Adobe and Premiere and everything. And that's going to change the movie industry. It's already changing. So you go to YouTube, you can download a movie that somebody just made, like in Canada. I've seen some guys make something similar to Mortal Kombat. It was the same exact quality. And they made it for maybe less than $5,000. A friend of mine, Robert Rodriguez, were in the same RTF class in San Antonio. He's famous, and I helped him support him and doing bands and selling food, you know, to fundraise. $3,000 is how much it cost us to make that movie, El Mariachi, and then Miramax bought it out. Now, the next industry is what I want to ask your opinion on that affects China and most of the world. Is basically, China has the factories. So you're talking about 3D printers. So 3D printers, now, they can do body parts. They can do kidneys. They already have kidneys that are functioning, that they take your DNA and your biometrics, and they say, okay, we're going to produce this enzyme, and we're going to 3D print it and make a kidney. Within 4 hours, they can do that. The kidney's functioning and works. So your body won't reject it. Now they're doing a heart. I think last week they did a heart. They've done ears, fingers, all that's all successful. Kidney successful. I don't know the heart successful yet. So where do you see that? And that's just biotech. Let's talk about just the factories with metal printing, plastic, everything. They've got it all. And that's just going to take away the industry and the factories the same way Napster did with the music industry, the way YouTube is doing for the movie industry with Hollywood. And now you have personal 3D printers that are... The cheapest I saw was $3,500. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I think it's going to be a noticeable while before 3D printers are seriously competing with factories, that you skipped an industry. The next industry is books. That it used to be the case that if you wanted to self-publish a book, they had what was referred to as vanity press, which meant that you paid money to the publisher, they printed up 100 copies, and you tried to get your friends and relatives to buy them. Nowadays, you can get a Kindle up on Amazon for zero cost. You can get a print-on-demand book up on Amazon for well under $100. And because of Amazon, you no longer need distribution. It's up there for the world to buy. So that I've been, the industry where I've been wondering is going to vanish is the publishing industry. My daughter is trying to start a career as an online freelance editor, on the theory that there are people out there who are writing books to self-publish and they need editors. So I think that's, so my first answer is I think that's the one where it's most immediately happening. But in terms of your point, it's not clear that is, first, your $3,000 3D printer is not going to print anything very much more than paperweights. That is, I've seen them operating. And at that scale, you're talking about making fairly simple plastic parts. The 3D printers that can do fairly complicated things are much, much more expensive at this point.
They're making houses, planes, all that. My thing is about change. People don't want to change.
Except if you look at what happened with music, don't you think it was an improvement? You eliminated the middleman. You eliminate the middleman. Similarly, I think it's going to happen with novels. That we need better ways of finding the needle in the haystack. Better ways, because the fact that somebody wants to publish a book doesn't mean it's worth reading. But that's coming. And that means that now everybody who wants to write can try to write. And the few that succeed can succeed.
So I think in many different things, no, I think one of the things that's happening is moving towards a more decentralized world, and I like that. I think most people would rather work for themselves than be employees. That one of the things that struck me wandering around Shanghai was that whereas groceries or other things are usually sold in the U.S. in one fairly big store, there are a few of those in Shanghai, but much more typically is this stall selling meat and this stall selling eggs and this stall selling meat and this stall selling fruit and so forth. It looks like there's an awful lot of very small business. And I expect one of the reasons, I suspect, is that people like to run their own things. And that strikes me as progress, not regress. And I think it'll happen in other... It won't happen in everything. There will be... That nanotech, if you get nanotech, the nanotech design is going to cost a fortune. Because if you're engineering a large object an atom at a time, you're talking about a huge design problem. But once you've got the first one, the rest are practically free. So that a nanotech economy looks like a software economy. All right, software, writing the first program is a lot of work. Copying it is easy. So you're going to have that. If we get nanotech, I don't know if we'll get, but if we get real nanotech, what molecular nanotech, the kind where you're building machines, not just materials, then you're going to get that kind of an economy. So, you know, I think on the whole, I would like a life, I like a world where more people are working for themselves, and that at least has been the pattern so far, and I hope it will continue.
Well, my main thing was, like, adaptation, changing, like, what people think is the norm. Like, back, I'm in between generations.
Thank you.
Between the generation that said, you work 20 years at a job, you never quit, you don't change jobs, that's unstable. You're not good. You're unstable. You're not a good worker. But I was in between those generations where the next generation behind me is they have to change jobs every year. And I was in the middle. And
yep.
I said, no, I'm going to change jobs. I'm going to learn every skill I can so that I'm adaptable and I can get a job anywhere doing anything.
Yep.
I can't just, oh, you're just the teacher. That's
My older son went to Harvey Mudd, which is a very, very elite sort of engineering school in California. And according to him, he and his friends think of life not as jobs, but as projects.
Right.
And that strikes me as a reasonable way of doing things. And I guess in a way, I think of it that way, too. That, you know, I write books, I build things, I do stuff, I research questions I want to know, and so forth. But, you know, it's a very diverse world of very different people. So that my gut feeling is I wouldn't like to be an employee of a very large firm. But there apparently are people who do like that kind of world. They like the security. They like someone else is making decisions except for one set which they get to make. And I expect that we're going to have a world that's many, many different worlds forever. And it probably should.
Thank you for your speech, Mr. President. And I am so appreciative to hear experts to discuss the future knowledge here, because maybe it's not very normal in China, public media to get that. Okay. I really agree with your point. The new technology has two sides. One side is good for people, and another side is bad, maybe. But we don't know results. We cannot predict. But actually, I think the problem is not a technology problem. It's a philosophy problem. Because long ago, sword can kill a person, and also it can protect a life.
Yeah.
So this problem is always exists in the history of human. I think the problems of human there's three parts. One part is from logical, another part is from the knowledge, and the other is from choose. The poet Eris in America has words What knowledge we lost in the information? What truth we what wisdom we lost in the knowledge? So my question is, how to find the truth in the world? If we can find the truth in the world, actually we have less questions about the world, because we know a story. Will be told from one to one by one. It will be shaped. Maybe a truth will be a lie. So I just want to discuss this topic with you. How to find the truth in the world. My English is not very good. I'm not very sure you understand me very clearly.
Yeah.
Okay. If you don't understand it, maybe someone can help me to translate.
Yeah.
Sorry.我的意思是，就是其实这个世界上大部分的问题都来自于三个部分，一部分是逻辑的，一部分呢是知识的，还有一部分呢是来自于真相，事实的真相。那很少人会问这个问题，到底怎么样才能发现这个世界的真相？因为很多信息它被传递的过程当中，它是会变形的。也就是说，它会改变，从一个人到另外一个人，它会改变，然后这样的话，它的真相就会越来越模糊，然后呢，就可能就没有人知道什么是真相了。所以我想跟弗莱德曼先生讨论的问题就是 ，how to find the truth？
真的。Yeah. Help me if I'm not right, but I think that he means that when we transfer information, we lose sense, more and more sense when we translate. If I want to say something to you and I translate it, I lose sense. And
yes.
And from one point of view, I lose the true meaning of what I want to say. How can you not lose it? Is that the idea?
I'm not sure. Give me the microphone. I'm not sure I understand what the question is. That is, obviously communication is imperfect, and I would have said that you only really understand ideas when you have invented them yourself, and that what other people do is to give you hints that help you invent things yourself. And if the idea is sort of real, then when you've invented it yourself, you finally got it. And you're going to have the same one as, I mean, the Pythagorean theorem is this. If you think about a theorem in mathematics, the second person gets exactly the theorem. But he gets it not because the first person could describe it exactly, but because the theorem is there to be gotten, and the first person told him enough so that he could get it. And I think that's true of ideas. There's somewhere I saw a quote from some, I assume, Chinese philosopher or something. I don't remember who. But it was the only piece of sort of exotic Eastern wisdom I've ever seen that I thought really sounded wise. And it was something like this. It was that the purpose of the rabbit trap is to catch the rabbit. Once you have the rabbit, you no longer need the trap. The purpose of the fish trap is to catch the fish. Once you have the fish, you don't need the trap. The purpose of words is to catch ideas. Where can I find someone who has forgotten words so I can talk with him? That is to say that if all you have in your head are the words, then you don't have the idea. And once the idea is there, you could express it in any different set of words. And that's part of the problem in communication, is that you're communicating in words, but the idea is to get across an idea. Yes. Actually, somebody back there who hasn't asked a question yet, I don't think.
Since I'm a student major in economics, I find out that when I view the new technology development from the aspect of the economy, I figure out that the externality of those new technology can be really troublesome. For example, with the development of biotechnology, we can imagine that in the future, maybe every couple may want to put in their baby through genetic manipulation.
Uh-huh.
And there can be someone who's too conservative that they refuse to use the technology.
Right.
So they put in their baby through old traditional ways,
yes.
That that may mean their baby is less perfect and is dominated by his or her peers. Is
that the behavior of those parents be normal, or shouldn't parents compensate for the loss of those parents to refuse? Yep. I agree that technology is likely to have externalities, but I expect them to mostly be positive, not negative, because after all, the child who is brilliant because his parents gave him the right gene might invent the cure for the cancer that would have killed the other child, might design the car that makes it easier for the other person, might write the novel that the other person reads and enjoys. But I don't think that as a general rule some people being more talented hurts other people. It could if they're direct competitors, but in most of human activity, since most of it is exchange, the fact that one person is smarter or stronger, unless they're fighting each other, smarter or stronger means can do things that you want better and more willing to do them and so forth. So, you know, I'm not saying there are no such effects, but I think that there that externality arguments in general are one of those things that are good in theory but bad in practice. Because once you know whether you're for or against something, you start to be very selective about which externalities you see. That my first piece of published economics was on population. And this would have been in, I suppose, the early 1970s, when the accepted view was that the reason poor countries were poor was they had too many people. And that it was very important that you keep down the number of people. And I tried to calculate what the net externalities were from having a child. I tried to figure out what are all the ways in which my child makes your children better off, all the ways in which they make them worse off. And I tried to add it up. And I concluded that I could not sign the sum. I couldn't tell if the sum was positive or negative. That's also my opinion about global warming. That I think if you look at the discussion, first people decide warming is bad. Then they look for every bad effect they can think of and don't look very hard for good effects. Then they say, look, there's a negative externality. And that's a fairly serious problem. So the argument would be right if you really did a fair job of calculating the externalities. But hardly any of us do.
Oh my God. 终于听到国语的回答提问，首先要谢谢这位小伙子，终于把话题递给我，我从开始到现在每次提问都举手，三条，不知道是不是我上次我欠了你的钱还是怎么样。首先，戴维先生能不能简单的一分钟或者简单一点的回答一下我的问题？首先我的问题，第一个问题是在未来30年中。 比特币在这个世界货币体系里面是占于什么样的位置，或者说你怎么看待比特币？第二个问题，如果你有100万美元的话，你会以多少财富，百分之几的财富以比特币的形式储存？非常商品。<笑> 回答完你能不能帮我那个简单翻译一下三句？
有人知道比特币是什么吗？
Bitcoin.
So, what's the development pattern of Bitcoin in the next 30 years, and would you invest in Bitcoin?
In one sense, the answer is yes, because I have. I have some Bitcoins. Prediction is hard, especially about the future. I think that Bitcoin may succeed, it may take off. It may be that some other version, you know, Bitcoin number two, so to speak, might take off. I think it is a good thing to have a world of competing private currencies, and I'm actually going to be giving a talk on that subject in Hong Kong in a few days. I have an old article I wrote for Cato long before Bitcoin, arguing that the real question for money is not whether it is gold or silver or paper. It is what are the incentives of the people producing it that will affect how they behave, whether they inflate or maintain value. But Bitcoin itself, anything new usually doesn't succeed. So I would say the odds that Bitcoin will still be going in 10 years are probably less than even. But they're significant. I mean, it's a very clever idea, and it may keep working. I'm afraid that's the best I can do. But I do have some. And I've made money on them. I think.
What does he want to know?
How many?
$1 million at purchase. How much you invest in Bitcoin?
1% of your wealth. I mean, the only answer I can give is what I have, and it's a very small percentage of my wealth. But then it's not something I pay a lot of attention to. Maybe I should do more. Good question.
You should research who made it, who developed it.
Well, I've seen a couple of different theories on that subject.
It's not better who made it.
What?
It's the IT protocol. It's not who made it.
What?
It does. Only how it works matters.
I'm in finance. I know who made it. The group was
definitely. You don't know.
It's an open protocol. Doesn't matter who the creator is anymore.
It does. Trust me. DARPA, I don't want to invest it. It's DARPA.
The internet.
I don't think it's DARPA. I don't think it's DARPA. I'd be very surprised if it was DARPA.
It does.
Thank you, and I have a very good question. Does it bother you that one day we may be replaced by robots or the mimic by robots?
You're talking about robots, was what you're asking? Yeah. I would not be happy to be replaced by a robot because I like living, and I would prefer that the people I care about not be replaced by robots either. I like my own species, and I hope it survives. But I would not be disturbed to think that 100 years from now, a significant fraction of the intelligent beings will be running silicon rather than carbon, will be programmed computers, and I think that might be an interesting world. And they're much better suited for things like space than we are. You can, after all, turn a program off for 100 years and turn it back on again. And stars are very far away.
One thing I should say, by the way, is that at some point in the next 2 weeks, I expect that the PowerPoint from this will go up on my webpage. So if people need to use it then, they can get it then. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Should be known, I simply came to listen to your lecture because of the reputation of your father.
That's a bad reason.
Yeah. you have described many technology advances in the future, but that reminds me of the nuclear weapons. What I mean is that they are not used until near the end of the Second World War, and it was first used by Americans to end the war to conquer Japan, and it was the first time, also the last time, for human beings to use that. And after that, Soviet Union has also invented such weapons. So I mean, even if most countries have technologies like NATO technologies or human intelligence, maybe we can see there is also competition, which is inevitable in this society. So I don't think that unless both China and America agree to restrict the research on nanotechnology, so that the negative features of the technology can be avoided. I believe that as long as many parts in this world have enough assets to research on such technology, we can also avoid the conflict in the use of the technology advance.
Yeah. Most of the things I'm worried about are not deliberate warfare. Most of the issues are ways in which, if a technology develops, it might, as it were, inadvertently cause very bad effects. So that I could easily imagine a country researching biological warfare or nanotechnological warfare, never deliberately using it, but somebody making a mistake. As you may know, there was apparently one case in the Soviet Union where the biological warfare got out and a bunch of people died in a particular city. And as the things get more powerful, those things could be larger disasters. And similarly, in the case of AI, what I would imagine is that the competition is that building better and smarter computers means you can do better on the stock market, better in diplomacy, better in many different ways, and each country builds them a little smarter, and making them self-aware and intelligent is an even better way of doing that, and then maybe the computers decide that we really aren't their bosses after all, and do things that we don't like. So I think the competition is the reason you can't stop it, as I said earlier.
Your father, Milton Friedman, is a famous and a great man. Could you talk about the influence of your father to you, according to your own experience?
He was certainly one of the best people I've ever known. When I said you shouldn't come to hear my talk, if you're interested in him, you might as well read his books, and many of his talks are webbed and so forth. I think very highly of him, but I'm not him. I'm a different person. I grew up arguing with him. A large part of my... I had somebody I knew in college who said she met somebody who met me and my father skiing, probably when I was in high school, and who said we spent all our time arguing, and I won half the arguments. And the second was not true. My score was never as high as 50%. But the first part was true. And I do it with my children too, because argument is not a fight. An argument is fun. An argument is exchanging ideas.
So what can I say? He, as far as I can tell, he was entirely honest. At least, as far as I know, he never told me a lie that I'm aware of. As far as I can tell, he answered all of his own mail before email, when it was hard work to answer all of it. He did have a secretary to retype things because his handwriting was pretty terrible, but almost as bad as mine. But I've heard from many people who wrote him out of the blue and got a coherent answer back. He didn't like arguing about whose fault things were. His response to any argument about whose fault it was, "It's my fault. My shoulders are broad." That was one of his lines. He and my mother, early on their marriage, had the idea that there were some things which it's very painful to say, and that one solution would be to replace them with numbers, so that for each thing you didn't really like to have to say, you would have a number. And that works in two ways. First, it's faster to get over it. And second, there's a certain amount of the fact that I'm using a number reminds me that I'm being brave to say something that's hard to say. And only one of them survived, but that survived in our family. Number two means you were right and I was wrong. So those are a few things. When I was growing up, we spent our summers in New Hampshire, lived in Chicago, and it was about a 2.5-day drive then to get there. And my father would tell us stories when we were kids. Sometimes we would tell, sometimes the kids or my wife or my mother would tell stories, but mostly my father. And there were a long series of stories about Mr. Gazookas, who had a traveling circus that different adventures happened to. And I revived Mr. Gazookas for my children long after. I didn't remember any of the original stories, but I made up a new set of stories. So that worked pretty well. What else? I will tell you about the success of our breeding program. We have had a 3-generation program to breed musical ability back into my father's descendants. That my mother claimed that she had taught my father one song well enough so he could tell if something was that song or wasn't. But he denied it. However, my father married a musical wife. I married 2 musical wives in succession. And the son of my first marriage married a musical wife. And the result is I have grandchildren who can sing. And if you don't believe me, I've got a recording I could prove it with. So, of their singing Happy Birthday for me. To email it to me, because I wasn't there. Not sure what else I can tell you. I mean, he was somebody I liked very much.
Can I just try to clarify his question? Because he wasn't satisfied by the answer. So a poet said that where the knowledge is, we lose in the information. Where the wisdom is, we lose in the knowledge.
I don't know what that means.
So when a story is told to someone, in the process of transmission, the story is, a part of the story is changed.
Yes.
And so governments can, or false experts can cheat people with false information and false statistics, I guess. But there is more and more information that is lost. How can we find the truth? And he mentions the 911 accident, and some people think that it's the U.S. government.
I don't understand. That is, how to find the truth is certainly an important question. And I think we have access to much more information than in the past, partly because almost all of us are online. And you can answer many questions in 30 seconds with Google as your helper. That the hard problem is figuring out what to believe. That the hard problem is when somebody tells you something, how do you decide whether to believe them? And I think the answer is that you can train yourself to evaluate sources of information on internal evidence. Does this person write as if he cared whether what he says is true? so that if you care whether what you say is true, you offer the best arguments against your position you can think of. If you care whether what you say is true, you qualify your statements. You mention, well, this is not true here, it's not true there. And I think with practice, one can to some extent distinguish people who should more or less, nobody should be trusted entirely because we all make mistakes, but people who are at least trying. So that when I look at arguments on global warming, for example, on the same side of the argument, there are some people who I think are wrong, but are clearly sort of honest, honorable people doing their best. And there are other people who I think are deliberately dishonest. And there are other people who I suspect couldn't tell the difference from their behavior. So I think the best you can do is you look at what somebody writes or says, and you try to decide how much can I believe him, how hard is he trying to tell the truth, and that's the best you can do.
So Peter Thiel wrote recently about how he thinks that even though we have a lot of innovation, market technology, we have a lot fewer moonshots and a lot fewer large-scale innovation. So do you agree with that idea? And do you think that accelerating change is a fundamental property of the universe?
That what is?
Accelerating change.
Is a fundamental property of the universe? No. As far as we know, the universe as a whole has not changed more today than it did yesterday, or than it did a billion years ago. But you don't know that life didn't evolve on some other planet 100 million years ago, or a billion years ago, or 10 billion years ago.
But I mean, if you look at how life has changed, we had 3 billion years where it changed very little, then we had, vertebrae and...
But you're talking about the universe, not Earth.
But I mean, if you look at, even the human history, changes come faster and faster. That's Kurzweil's theory. And I'm asking, do you think that that's true, and do you think that...
I don't know. I think at the moment that change is probably happening faster, because there's positive feedback from technology. This is sort of Werner Vinge's point about the singularity, that you make better computers, and the better computers can be used to make still better computers. And you learn how to cure cancer, some cancers, and some people survive to learn how to cure other cancers. But I don't know if it'll keep being the case, because if you look at sort of the economic logic, sometimes you run into situations where you get diminishing returns. And I don't think you can know for sure in the future whether we will run into a diminishing... maybe it'll turn out that at some point we've learned all the easy things, and it'll be another 300 years before we start learning hard things. I just don't know.
But Peter Thiel thinks that invasion is solved, and all that human invasions are trivial. Do you think that's true?
No. I think that's unlikely to be true. I haven't read Peter's piece, so I don't know. He's a smart guy. But I don't really have an opinion on whether that some innovation is still happening. But how do you distinguish innovation happening from the effects of innovation working themselves through the world? That there's a certain sense in which the new things we're doing with the internet aren't really depending so much on technological change of the last 5 years than of our taking account of the technological change of the last 25 years. If the way I sometimes put it is my first computer was an LNW80, which was a super clone of the TRS-80, which was really one of the first mass market personal computers. Suppose somebody said, I'm going to offer you a choice. You can have a 50% chance of the computer you now have, and a 50% chance of no computer, or a certainty of the computer you had then. I'd probably take the certainty. I'm not sure. There are some things I couldn't do. But I could write just fine on that computer. I wrote a book on it. And I couldn't write just fine without a computer. After I wrote my second book, I concluded that prior to the invention of the word processor, no books were written. It's just too much work. But...
Mm-hmm. kind of very corrupt. I'm agreeing to you that the government intervention is the idea of government intervention is less and less convincing. But I mean, in recent years, there's a lot of research and news reports come out talking about the reality in the United States: the rich get richer, poor get poor.
That what?
The rich get richer and poor is getting poor.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yes, so, the second part isn't true.
Okay. Anyway, so I also noticed that recently there's one friend
Picardy is
write about the one book in the 21st century capitalism, right?
Yeah. I have not read Picardy, so I can comment on the I haven't read Picardy's book, so I can comment on the argument but not on what he says. And the simple version of his argument is that if the interest rate is faster than the rate of economic growth, then people who are accumulating wealth at the interest rate will have a larger and larger share. And first, that assumes that capitalists never consume anything. Right? If I'm living off my interest rate, what's going to pay for my yachts and my caviar and, you know, my divorces and all those things? So what you need is not just the interest rate is faster than the economic rate of growth, but the interest rate minus the consumption of the people who are living on interest has to be higher than what he's saying. Maybe, but I don't know why. If his argument is right, it should have been right in the past, and that has not been the pattern in the past, that if you look at how ordinary people live now compared to how ordinary people lived 100 years from now, surely the difference is bigger than the difference between how the rich live now and the rich lived 100 years ago. That, you know, the ordinary people now have color televisions and CDs and computers and antibiotics, which nobody had 100 years ago. So far I don't think it's been true. I think my guess is that if income inequality grows, the reason will not be his reason. That the major source of income is human labor. And what might be true is that the difference in productivity of different kinds of labor might increase. That if you think about the difference between labor that's mostly your body and labor that's mostly your mind, over time we've gotten better and better substitutes for labor that's mostly your body. We have machines. We don't need ditch diggers because we've got machines to dig things. Now, we're getting some substitutes for some part of the mind, too, with computers. But it might turn out, suppose it turns out, that the things that the bottom half of the ability distribution can do don't become more valuable as fast as the things the top half can do. That would give you an increased inequality of income for a reason entirely unrelated to the Piketty argument. Does that make sense? And that's my guess insofar as it's happened. My guess is what's happening, but I don't really know. And of course, on the world scale, it's exactly the opposite. That you have to realize that on the world scale, inequality has sharply fallen. If you don't realize that, look around you. You live in a country which has, what, a third of the world's population, a quarter of the world's population, something like that. What's the population of China now? What? 1.6 billion. So you've got about a fifth of the world's population. 30 years ago, essentially everybody in China was dirt poor. It isn't true anymore. People in America aren't that much better off. People in America are a little better off than they were 30 years ago. But people in China are enormously better off than they were 30 years ago. That's a huge decrease in the world inequality. No? Much bigger than anything that's happening within the U.S. And in a sense, you have to realize that you're living in the middle of one of the best things that's ever happened in human history. The fact that 1.6 billion people are coming out of a kind of poverty that I find it hard to imagine, and that probably even you find it hard to imagine because you're not old enough. Maybe you did live through some of it. it's hard to think of any change that fast. You could argue that people migrating to America and then getting rich was a similar change, but it was a change that took a century or more. This one is in 30 years. And I think it's beginning to happen in India, too. I think it's not as, not, hasn't gone as far, but I think India is also beginning to come out. So in that sense, I think in the world, incomes are becoming more equal. And that strikes me as a good thing, because it means more people are happy and more interesting things getting done and more stuff being produced and things.
So what would you think is the biggest problem with the current mechanism in the United States? Because
the biggest problem is that we have a government that does too many things.
So we all, I mean, in China we have introduced the free market, I mean, countries, right?
Yeah.
So in the United States, the free market is one thing a lot of people admire, right?
Well, yes and no. Everybody is in favor of the free market for everybody else.
Right.
But everybody wants government protection for himself. The only exception are professors. Professors want freedom for themselves and government control for everybody else. But most people... So no, I mean, in rhetorically, people in America are in favor of the free market, and maybe more so than they were 30 or 40 years ago. But the size of the U.S. government hasn't gone down. The total volume of regulations hasn't gone down. That's what I would like to reduce government intervention, but I don't expect it to happen. I hope it'll happen, but I don't expect it to happen.
Okay, time is running short. The last question. If anyone didn't ask a question,
what do you think about intelligence? I mean, more higher, more mercy, or more higher, more evil, or more complicated, or more self-control? Do you really think AI would be any help with this being?
As far as I can tell, there is no way of deducing right and wrong. I don't think anyone has come up with an argument to prove morality. And without that, it is very hard to know how a different intelligent being would see things. That we are intelligent. We are much more intelligent than insects. But we don't find swatting mosquitoes to be a bad thing. Mosquitoes might disagree. So I don't know if we had very intelligent computers whether they would be what we think of as good or not. I don't see how I can predict that. But if I look at people, some very intelligent people I've known were very good people. I'm not sure I've known anybody very intelligent. I know people who are pretty intelligent who I thought were not very nice people. But I'm not. I don't see a very clear correlation between intelligence and how nice you are. So, even within our species, let alone across some very different species.
The correlation between IQ and people.
What?
People with higher IQs are less likely to be in prison.
Yeah, but that could mean they're less likely to get caught. It could mean they're more likely to have more attractive alternatives to crime. So, anyway. Yeah. Thank you all.